Christmas time is here, by golly, disapproval would be folly. Deck the halls with hunks of holly, fill the cup and don't say when. Kill the turkeys, ducks, and chickens, mix the punch, drag out the dickens. Even though the prospect sickens, brother, here we go again. On Christmas Day, you can't get sore, your fellow man you must adore. There's time to rob him all the more, the other 306, a T, a 4.
Hello and welcome to the Nattercast special Christmas, the Nattercast Christmas special. First annual Nattercast Christmas special, coming out of Schenkel Studios. I am Jason Schenkel, and I'm here as always with my lovely wife,
the Christmas elf,
the Christmas elf Sion Schenkel, and we're here to natter at you about to send out a Happy Christmas, Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays to everybody, and to natter about our favorite Christmas tradition: the watching of our two favorite Christmas movies, Christmas Story, A Christmas Story, and Die Hard.
Ta-da!
Before we get into that, though, I'll give you our contact information. As always, you can get us at nattercast@gmail.com, and we are on Facebook. If you search for Nattercast, you'll find us there. And as always, 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 please subscribe and rate. 5-star ratings, please, on iTunes, where you can
find us.
Yes, please. And but before we get into the movies, Sion wanted to shout out to some people for a Merry Christmas.
Yes, I did.
Did you?
But I was going to do it throughout the cast, honey.
You're going to do it throughout the cast? Okay, well, then we'll just roll in to the movies then. How about that?
All right, then.
All righty, then. So every year, Sion and I, our two favorite Christmas movies that we watch...
Merry Christmas to the Talbots Who Live Next Door and, like, Our Perfect Neighbors.
Okay, so you're going to do it throughout the cast, meaning throughout the following sentence. Throughout the next 10 seconds.
Just gonna do it.
Over the course of the next 10 seconds, I'll be
when this eggnog inspires me to. And this year, I'm not adding, and this is, here, I have a cautionary tale for you guys.
Mm.
Last year, we got into bed for Christmas Eve. This is when our tradition started. Well, it's actually started several years before. We get in our little spot, I have a little eggnog. I don't know what you were doing. And we were just getting ready to watch our movies. And I thought I'd be really clever and grind fresh nutmeg on my eggnog.
Mm-mm.
So after easily a teaspoon per drink, within like three drinks, I was like, whoa, okay. These are just little cups, you know, nothing big. And I'm like, okay, nothing. Sometime around 6 or 5 in the morning, I thought I'd eaten glass. It postponed my Christmas for a while.
Kind of brought you down.
Nutmeg is kind of intense, what it can do to you.
Yeah, kind of intense. They kind of use it to fight heroin addiction.
Well, that's no. If you want to have your insides cleaned out with shards of glass,
that'll do it for you.
So the nutmeg got thrown out, and there is none floating on the top of this
top of your
creamy eggnog substance. I learned my lesson.
That's good. That's good. We should have added that.
You were calling it buttmeg.
Buttmeg. We should have put that. Should have been a vignette in Christmas Story. There should have been a nutmeg poisoning
incident. Oh, it's just painful.
Anyway, this is our two favorite Christmas movies: A Christmas Story, starring Peter Billingsley, 1983, with Darren McGavin and people I don't remember whose names they are. And this is, you know, this is a sort of a traditional classic. Wait a second. You don't have your headphones plugged in.
No, I don't, but I can still.
No, come on, man. You need your level.
I need my level.
Got to get your level.
Give me my level.
Hold on a second.
I need to go to the next
you didn't
level.
Even say a thing about it. There you go. All right. You're all plugged in now. Okay. Anyway, so Peter Billingsley plays a little kid who wants, in the 1940s, who wants a Red Ryder BB gun for Christmas, and of course he's facing the great parental gun block of "you'll shoot your eye out," and it's all about him having to overcome that. And then our second feature for Christmas has been one that I'm going to go off on a little thing here, because I've been saying this for like 20 years that Die Hard is probably one of the best Christmas movies ever made. And all throughout the 90s, I would get this look from people like this, you know, "where's the butterfly net" kind of look, and they'd say, "what's your favorite Christmas movie?" And I'd say, "well, Die Hard," you know. And just now, the internet is starting to catch up with this idea, and we saw it. It was in the Chronicle, San Francisco Chronicle. It was in Forbes. It was in the Nashville Screen Scene. It was in Empire Online. All these places are putting Die Hard like number one and number two. Certainly up in the top five, the Christmas movies. And so we've made it kind of our tradition here to watch these two films.
And Merry Christmas to Brian and Mike, who live on the other side. Fabulous neighbors.
Fabulous neighbors, Brian and Mike, who invited us to their party last week. That was a lot of fun. And yeah, and they have a house that's just like ours. It's the mirror of ours. So whenever we walk into their place, it's like, oh, this is what stuff is supposed to look like.
Yeah. Well, there's not exactly the mirror. They're just tripped out.
Architecturally, it's the
it's
mirror.
Fully restored.
It's fully restored. Whereas ours
is dilapidated and eccentric.
I would say, unique. Anyways, it's got its own charm. It's got a rustic charm to it. But say it's holding together, you know, when we're making it work.
So anyways, you must be feeling much better now that you've been vindicated.
I have been vindicated by the internet. Yes, completely. On the John McClane, Die Hard Christmas experience. So I feel really good about casting about this year because I won't have to be answering a bunch of questions about what are you crazy or whatever. There's a little debate going on. I usually try to throw Lethal Weapon into the Christmas season as well. But I'm less committed to the idea of Lethal Weapon being a great Christmas movie. There's a little debate out there as to whether Die Hard or Lethal Weapon is. But I think for pure joy, it's got to be Die Hard, because Lethal Weapon is all, first of all, Mel Gibson, so there's a little controversy there. And then it's all bound up in this contemplating suicide, and, you know, and there's just, it's a meaner movie. Whereas Die Hard's a lot more fun, I think. It has a lot more of the spirit of the season in it.
Really?
Yeah.
It's nearly genocidal, but that's your spirit of the season.
It's, okay, there's plenty of reasons. First of all, spirit of giving. There is the spirit of giving throughout it. It is about a little German boy who's trying to find his detonators. You know, and so that's always something nice. Yeah,
it's got the real Saint Nick spirit on it.
There's no one like weeping on a couch holding a gun in their mouth at any point in the film. You know, everyone who dies kind of like is signing up for some action. So anyway, so Christmas Story, based on Gene Shepard's. One of Gene Shepard's stories in God We Trust, All Others Must Pay Cash. And I guess I saw this movie when I was a kid. It came out when I was about 13. And it's one of these things.
You serious?
Yeah. I'm serious. It came out when I was 13.
This is where I'm reminded of our age difference. I'm like, I was in college.
Yeah,
and
well.
You were 13.
And this is, 30 years ago, so okay. It's okay. We've caught up since then to each other a bit.
I like the way you haven't analyzed that because there's a similar age difference in when women pass away versus men.
Mm-hmm.
You think
we're gonna nail it.
We have a chance to get real close to our deaths being simultaneous.
Exactly, which is,
considering we're almost constantly together, it's likely.
Yeah. I just hope that most of our passengers will survive.
Well, yeah. I do have a habit of driving kind of crazy, so. Oh, we're golden. We can totally do this.
Oh, we can totally do this. We're golden.
I could not find.
Couldn't find
the
first
gear.
We're in Hawaii.
We're in this really dangerous.
We're
area.
Out in the middle of fucking nowhere in Hawaii, going out to the Emerald Beach. It's like the only green beach in the world. And it's also like 20 miles away
it's
from
anything.
It's all
tourmaline crystals. It's really amazing.
Yeah, but to get there, you need an off-road vehicle. And it's actually, if you got one, you can kind of make it.
Hey, I rescued some people on the way back.
You did. You did perfectly well. But it really helps to be able to find the gear when you're on the side of the mountain and you're trying to trundle over.
And you're tilting.
And you're rolling
severely.
Back and sliding back and tilting back.
Then there was the time, another Hawaii trip where I dropped a tranny.
And they like...
Up the transmission, up on...
dropped a tranny.
Up there on Science Mountain.
Is it Friday night already?
Up there on Science Mountain.
You dropped a transmission.
And they had to rescue me, but then I just coasted it all the way back to Kona and just exchanged for another vehicle, no questions asked.
We lost another one.
Even though I went where I was supposed to not go, where there was no oxygen.
We're specifically asking you not to go to Emerald Beach and not to go up Mauna Kea. Okay. It's like those are the first two places on our on the GPS.
Let's go. Why do you get these things so you can go those places?
You got to be careful, man. They're going to start putting GPSs in those. They're going to know when you're lying your ass off. It's just like when you promise the rental people you're not going to take their RV to Burning Man. You just happen to be renting it on Labor Day because you're going to go camping.
Oh, yeah. That's when everybody moves, honey.
Yeah, yeah, sure. Absolutely. Yeah. Totally. On Labor Day. Do the labor. So anyway, so back to A Christmas Story. The things about this movie, I kind of have my notes here on what I really like about it. One is, it captures the kid's point of view on Christmas, I think, just perfectly. This idea of it being this completely magical time when you can get, you're living throughout your year under this like matrix of adult supervision, which pervades the film. It's like at every point in the movie, there's this sense that adults are in charge. Adults have the final say. There's you can maybe try to pull one over on them, but you certainly cannot defy their authority, and you can't do anything that's like that. And the adults are all kind of cartoonish caricatures, because we're not really seeing the world from their point of view. We're seeing it from this kid's point of view, and he's just trying to solve this problem of how to get granted this gift, right? And he goes to he's got the mom and the dad and the teacher and Santa Claus, and like these are the adults that he has to manipulate. And and I can remember that, like growing up, that sense of like Christmas was just this thing that they had over you. it was like if you're going for parole.
Right.
Right. It's like the
and
parole board.
It's perfectly timed too, during the dark, winter months where kids are playing indoors.
Right, dark winter months.
You can't get rid of your kid as easily. So they're in the house more, they're bugging you, so they're like, Christmas is coming.
Absolutely. Christmas is coming, don't let Santa Claus see you do this or that, and so you have to like keep it together while you're going stir crazy, cabin fever, and everything like that. And of course you want a gun so you can shoot somebody's eye out,
Or shoot your own eye out.
And I have a theory that I've been developing. I'll be developing it throughout the cast here, that Ralphie is John McClane.
Right.
Like Ralphie grows up to be John McClane. Now, I think the years don't quite work out. So Ralphie will be about 10 years old in 1945. John McClane is a little bit shy of 40 in 1987, 86, I guess. The movie came out in 88, but it could be 86, 87 that it took place in. So really, he'd be like an infant, when Ralphie was growing up. But I think if we can push Ralphie into the 50s and move McClane back into the early 80s, we can make this work. And there are a lot of things in common. We have gun fetishism.
Yep.
We have love of cowboys,
mm-hmm.
right? We have, cursing being a big thing, right? McClane can't keep his fucking mouth shut.
We also have two leading, maternal figures, so to speak, that have bad hair.
Yeah, we have maternal figures with bad hair.
The same bad hair.
Yes. We have like, insane bullies, and that kind of stuff. I'm like working up this thing where maybe like Ralphie could have grown up to have been John McClane. And then you had this great idea that Hans is like the younger brother.
Oh, totally.
Especially in the showdown at the end, yeah. Where it's the two of them, just gunning off against each other. And it's like, it could have been the little brother. I thought that was great. The other thing I really liked this movie was, the kids' performances, especially Billingsley, but also the younger brother. Just, it's just like we saw Hugo last week,
mm-hmm.
right? And I always walk into a movie, if kids are going to be carrying a movie, I'm very nervous going in. I'm like, Jurassic Park and this kind of thing, where it's like, it's not their fault. I mean, they're kids. But it's a rare director who can really get a performance out of a kid that touches me as an adult, where I feel like, oh, that's coming across really well. And I thought that Billingsley was great with that. It's like he was doing something very tough to do. He was matching the emotional tone of the adult narrator. It's like it's done in this Wonder Years format where the adult narrator is nostalgically narrating mm-hmm. his childhood. And he was like hitting the rhythm of Gene Shepard's narration and making the right facial, remarks for that. And obviously it wasn't a timing thing. They were choosing it with editing and everything else like that. But it's just, I haven't seen too many kid performances better than Peter Billingsley's in this movie.
I think when it opens up, you see the kids with their little noses pressed against the glass mm-hmm. while they're analyzing this window.
Right.
And it was just great.
Yeah. It has almost like this little Rascals quality to it. It's like that was like the mm-hmm. last generation where they're the rascal dynamic was governing kid behavior.
Well, I wasn't raised in the 40s, but
the age difference isn't that much.
Pliskin. Anyway, as I was saying, oh, yes. Jesus.
You weren't raised in the 40s, but...
I related a lot to the over padded clothing, the mittens, that hat, that long stocking hat. I had one of those.
The mittens that go through your sleeves.
Oh, just the whole nine yards. And, you know, running to school and all the social pitfalls awaiting you, like the yellow brick road on the way to and from school.
Yeah, I used to walk to school. Yeah. Like that, yeah.
And it just all that, I totally, and you don't see that much in kids' lives as much anymore.
Not around here so much. I mean, maybe a little in the burbs, you know, and elsewhere. But here in the big city, you're seeing kids are basically being transferred. It's like prisoner transport.
It's true. They block my you know, driveway.
It's like you're being
driven near a big school.
You're being driven to school with Bobby Munson and Big Otto. You know, and we got you on lockdown. You know, kids are on lockdown around here. And the other thing is,
for no good reason.
Yeah, and you like look at the playgrounds, which are probably full of pseudoestrogens, which is why girls are going through puberty
they're
at age 3 and boys
rubber.
Not until 20.
You can't skin your knee at all.
You can't hurt. You can just throw yourself. It's like a rubber room. You can throw yourself against these things as hard as you want, and you're never going to hurt yourself. When I was growing up, it was big pieces of lumber with rusty nails in it.
Oh, I've seen the pictures too.
Which is what they built everything out of. It's like, oh, what's a little tetanus? You know, it toughens you up. Kind of thing. So yeah, there was this, in A Christmas Story, you get this quality of the kids are living in a dangerous world, and that's why they're kind of so huddled close to adults, you know, is because, yeah, they have the snowball fights and the bullies and the dogs and the you know and everything and the electricity that can burn your house down and all this other stuff. So you need a dad who's who can get down there and fight a furnace, and you need a mom who knows how to keep it together.
The furnace, oh, that was great. Oh, I've lived in homes like that.
So this is my father. Speaking of Merry Christmases to the Schenkel family, this is my father's favorite part of this movie. He really liked this movie. My whole family did. Growing up is that, you know, we grew up in a pretty permissive environment, generally speaking, but one thing we could not do was profanity. You know, we had some of them we could do, but basically the sort of the Carlin, the Big Seven, were just completely off the table for us. If you got overheard using that, you were going to get a talking to. And so he loved that in the movie, whenever the profanity got to like the above the PG-13 level, it goes completely like into gibberish. And so Darren McGavin is down there fighting the furnace and going, Husgrafenfager, it's a Lufner, it's a Lufner. You know, and just like, and the narration is like, I just heard this stream of profanity coming out of the basement. And it's like, you're hearing none of it, you know, because they wanted to keep it PG, I guess, you know, but it adds a charm to the film. You know, that you're seeing the verbal, you hear the verbal equivalent of like the exclamation mark, pound sign, question mark, zigzag, you know, swears that you see in cartoons and things like that. Yeah. Let's see what else we had here. Yeah, so we had the fake swearing. We had Darren McGavin, you know, he's a great, the parents really are great in the film, you know.
Yeah, like, they're great parents.
Yeah, they're very, I mean, and they're effective parents.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, they're not, in fact, you get this sense, and it's another kind of sweet sense of like the adult authority in the film, is that when they get in trouble, he's got to wash his mouth out with soap. That's actually a little bit hideous thing to do to a kid, I think. That's like the most abusive thing that you see. But there's this fantasy that he's got in his head that there's just going to be these beatings and these hangings, these stabbings and everything. And the parents never discipline them like that. And even the mom, like, doesn't rat him out about the fight, and yeah, and then the kid's like, oh, but daddy's gonna kill Ralphie, and it's like, oh, don't be silly, your father is not going to kill Ralphie. And you get the sense, you start to see that the kids are seeing the world in this hyperbolic way. They're seeing everything highly exaggerated.
Well, they don't want to disappoint their parents. They have a really strong relationship with them.
Right. But the parents also, they have this sense of proportionality around disciplining their kids. They're not doing it. They're not venting their emotions.
Yeah, they're not taking out their own frustrations and anger.
Even though they are emotional characters.
Yes.
You know, they have a lot of emotions.
And they're stressed out.
And they're stressed out and everything. They're not venting on their kids. They're parenting them correctly.
Right.
You know, and so that is just like...
Yeah, like when the little kid refuses to eat on a regular schedule. So she does that whole, like, well,
What's a little piggy do?
And then he starts, like, putting his snout in the food and starts eating. And everyone else at the table is like, what the? And she's just like,
go totally, that would be me. You know,
like, that was really...
What are you doing?
I thought that was so cute.
Well, I was not the non-eater in the family. I was the eater in the family. I was the older brother. My youngest brother was the non-eater. And he literally went through a period of years where all he would eat is Taco Bell. I mean, just, and not even just Taco Bell, but Taco Bell burritos. It's like, I don't know how he got all his nutrition. They must have been slipping in something at night. But, yeah, so I remember that whole, like, frustrating experience of, will you just eat your food, you know? And then the other thing that's nice about the film is that even though there's this overarching story about the gun and trying to get the gun, there's a lot of little vignettes that really kind of capture, it's not just like 40s stuff because, you know, it came out in the 80s. It had to capture kind of universal kid experiences. And, one of them was the ice tongue on the pole, putting your tongue on the icy pole.
Oh, wow.
And the whole like double dare, triple dare, double dog dare, getting up to the... And now, how could you not know? How could you not have in your head that putting your tongue on this icy pole is going to stick there? You know, you'd think the physics
of it... If you haven't experienced it or seen it done to someone else...
You'd think they look for
fresh, ignorant meat among the herd of children.
I guess so. And I guess this is how you learn.
My sister was talked into it. That it's this horrible, sadistical thing that kids have to...
Just go through.
It's like one kid has to make that sacrifice every winter.
Right. It's
for the group.
It's speaking of Christmas, it's Christ-like. Oh, one kid has to sacrifice while in front of witnesses so that we can all be saved the tongue-pulling ice torture. And they don't even do this. They just tear his fucking face right off of that thing.
It's
a fire department goes out. And it's like, what do you need the fire department to tear a guy's face off a pole for? Why can't you do
that?
Yeah. And the way you fix that is with warm water. You roll warm water down the pole and it melts the ice. And your tongue is still going to be burned. You know, you're still fucked up. But you don't have to pull all the tissue off. Ah, that's got to really hurt. You know, let's see. And then we had the Scott Farkas, the sort of the hierarchy of kiddom with the victim, the toady, and the bully. It's like you can be one of the victims. We didn't have a lot of really bad bullies like of our age growing up. We had some bad bullies who were like 10 years older, where there was no stand up to him thing. It's like you're 9 and he's maybe 17, so like maybe 8 years older. It's like, forget it. There's no, I'm not going to fight somebody who's twice my size, you know, and has upper body strength and things and stuff like that. But I did recognize especially a little bit of like the taunting and having the toady, you know, and hence like, oh, come here so I can make you say uncle. And it's just like for no reason other than just to do it. And
just exercise authority.
Just exercise your authority, yeah. And then, the Bumpus Hounds. You want to talk about them at all?
This herd.
This herd of hounds.
Yeah, this herd of bloodhounds. Just starts, like, goes after the turkey.
And they're never around except for in their scenes.
Yeah, I mean, you know? It's just great.
They just go after the turkey.
And one of them, there was one shot where one of the hounds, it's like, it just part of his back upper hip was, like, right in the camera. And I was trying to figure out how that happened. Because it was a little out of place. And I was like, whoa, that one's like, I thought it was in a 3D movie there for a split second.
Hugo and the Bumpuses.
And living, you know, as I do... over the years with various dogs of similar personalities like those dogs.
You're pretty much the Bumpus Hound factory.
The enabler.
Dog enabler.
But yeah, it's like Jason went to work a few days ago and I'm just getting out of bed at the same time and I'm hearing this, what sounds like is someone unwrapping a Christmas present or wrapping one.
Yeah, because
I know this is not an authorized sound.
It was totally unauthorized.
And I get up, and Jason has left a bunch of bread in a package that he's supposed to take to work with
him. Totally forgot to take my bread to work to make
my
sandwiches.
And Misha was just going at it, but she didn't get to it. So.
Yeah, I left here. I got to work. I'm like, it was like an hour and a half later that I was at work. I'm like, oh, oops. And so I had to leave you this text. Because I went to the dentist first.
That explains a lot. I was trying to figure out how the bread got there.
I thought I was totally screwed because that was my dentist day. So I had been at the dentist for like an hour. Without realizing that I'd forgotten the bread. It wasn't until I got to work. So I was like, oh, 90 minutes, there's no way this... I almost didn't even send you a text. I was like, there's no way this bread... Either she got it or there's no way this bread survived.
Well, it survived already.
Because you got it before getting the text.
Because she's just going to turn it into poo, and then poo when she's mad at us. And make us step in it.
Yes. And then there's the major award. the leg lamp. This is like Spinal Tap goes to 11. This is like, I do not think that word means what you think it means. This is a film classic, comedy classic from the 80s.
He doesn't know what it is. He's getting this big award. And it's completely, it's like he's blinded to the fact that it's humiliating for his wife.
Yeah, he's got no concept at all.
And that it's inappropriate for his children.
And tacky. And
he's fussing with, I want this.
I want one too.
I think we can make one pretty easily.
I want to get the whole rest of it and build the whole lady.
All right, now this is getting weird.
Plastic glowing lady. Well, I got to distract the cat with something.
Like Sons of Anarchy when they had those dolls.
I have to distract the cat with something.
You'd be frightened, but completely erect.
Terrified, but totally erect. Which is what would happen if you saw this lamp up close.
For those of you who haven't been keeping up with Sons of Anarchy or our cast, that was...
Tig's line. Yeah.
Yeah, it was... Oh, man, that was a great line.
When he saw the real doll, basically.
Yeah, those sex dolls. Sex dolls. He was like looking at it going, what?
He's like pinching its nipples.
I'm scared.
They put a lamp in it.
I'm scared, but I'm totally erect.
Totally erect. So, yeah, so he's out there. He's got in the middle of... And then I love when they're going out to the department store to see Santa. And she goes into the house and unplugs the lamp and comes back out and says, I don't want to waste electricity. And the whole rest of the house is ablaze. It's like all the lights upstairs are on, all the lights downstairs are on, the tree is on, the porch light is on. You know,
the polite passive aggressive.
She's like totally passive aggressive. And then she just destroys it while cleaning. And he's like, you used all the glue on purpose because you hate this lamp. You hate that I won an award. And he thinks that she's resenting his success.
Which it doesn't seem like her style.
Not at all. She's resenting the expression of his success. She's resenting the
results.
He's
an Oldsmobile man.
He's an Oldsmobile man, yeah.
Yeah. I love that line.
The Harsen Fracken Grossenpfeffer. You know, they get the flat tire. It's like his spare tires are only tires in like the technical sense.
And that oven and stove were so cute. I think those are the same. I think your parents still have something like that, don't they?
My parents, you know, they have like a 1960s electric oven stove thing.
Really? It has that same heavy cast iron.
Oh no, it's aluminum. It's light ass aluminum.
Light ass.
Especially light ass aluminum. I grew up with it. I recall
our parents. No. I mean, our fathers are not going to want to hear this cast.
No.
I thought I could do it without cussing.
It took me until moving to it wasn't my first apartment. My first apartment had a terrible stove, but my second apartment had a decent stove, and it was like, oh, this is how you're supposed to be able to cook. Look, I can control the heat. That's great. Who thought of that? No, electric. You know, I grew up with an electric stove, and that is just.
But it doesn't. It looks like something from the 40s.
No, it's 60s. It's okay. Definitely 60s. Okay. Yeah, yeah. Maybe late 50s, possibly. But it was. It's an aluminum special.
It's special.
Yeah. It's like my uncle and my grandparents' house. They had the stoves that were like these giant World War II era iron submarines.
That's what I'm thinking of. Craig's stove.
Oh yeah, no, that's from like the 30s or something.
Yeah,
like,
that's huge.
That was Red October.
Yeah.
You know, Red October with four burners. So the major award, and then and then Ralphie's got to help him with the change the tire, and he loses the nuts,
and he
says the F-dash-dash-dash word.
And I love, you know, because you see this, and you see this, like, this horror on his dad's face, and, you know, this whole, and then Louis C.K. has this great bit recently,
mm-hmm.
Particularly in regard to the N-word.
The N-word.
He's basically like, and he just goes ahead and says it.
Right.
He says, because if you go around saying the N-word, what you have done is you're forcing the other person to say it in their head.
Yes, exactly.
And that is disgusting.
Right.
If you want to say it.
Just say it.
You need to own it, and you need to be the one that says it.
Yeah.
Not put it in someone else's head by this passive-aggressive... The N-word.
Yeah, he said, I'm offended by the N-word. And he says, not the real word, the phrase the N-word.
Right.
You know? It's like, you know, well, okay.
Look. It's the same thing. It's like...
Well, it's the same thing, except for right here, he's not... Yeah, he says the F-dash-dash-dash word. He says F-dash-dash-dash again because they want to get PG-13 or PG out of the movie, you know. But what's great is that the mother, like, puts him in interrogation. She soap boards him, you know. And it's like, where did you hear this word? And he's like, are you kidding? Dad yells this word 15 times a day. But he can't say that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I always felt like that was a little bit like, What I would have done there is like, I honestly can't remember. Nobody took me aside and told me this word. I've just heard it around. What do you want from me? I don't have anybody to rat out. But he rats out his friend, Flick, or whatever. And the mother calls the other mother. Right, she's got the phone. Mm-hmm. And she whispers. She whispers it. Here's he said. And then you hear this scream come out of the receiver. Oh, my God. And then it goes off into the distance. And then you hear this little kid going, what is it? What is it? Oh, my God. You hear this kid being beaten. You know, like with like a cane or something like that, you know, while Ralphie is sitting there, like feeling guilty about ratting his friend out and feeling resentful of his parents. And it's just like, that was what profanity was like in my house, you know, growing up. Was like, it was this, you know, where did you hear that word? It's like, are you kidding? I'm growing up in San Francisco.
Absolutely.
We have people running for mayor named Fuck. Fucky McFuckerton is, you know, is right on the ballot. What are you talking about?
In my the first time I ever said any cuss word, because we weren't allowed to say my God, none of that.
Mm-hmm. See, we could say my God.
No, we were just...
We couldn't say God damn it, but we could say
we couldn't, God. Nothing.
We could say Christ, get the fuck out of here.
No.
No, we couldn't do that.
Say anything.
Yeah.
And, but I also wasn't around people who were cussing.
Mm.
So really? And I only heard my father cuss once.
Yeah, my parents never cussed.
He said damn, and he was under extreme stress.
Had he won a major award?
No. My mother was so mad at him. And my parents didn't usually ever get physical or verbally abusive in their tiffs. But it was one of the times where she was super, super, super mad at him. And so, and he was hassling her about cooking. So she got up. Went into his little office area, grabbed his big box of coins that he just finished sorting. We're talking at least a couple $1,000 worth of pennies.
Uh-huh.
And dumped them on the living room floor.
Oh.
He said,
talk about passive aggressive.
He said, damn it. That's not passive aggressive. That's aggressive.
That's aggressive aggressive, I guess. Well, no, dumping them over your head would be aggressive.
Yeah. It's like, whoa.
Whoa.
I was scared.
That's pretty brutal.
He was like, damn it.
Yeah. You know, damn it.
Which, of course, I don't think made him feel good, but...
Yeah. I think I heard damn it a couple of times. Damn was kind of on the borderline.
No, we got nothing.
Damn and hell were on the borderline. It's but like you could get away with like one a day.
I was 12. Yeah. I'll never forget. And I was sitting at lunch. It was just me and my younger sister. And I whispered damn intentionally. And she started giggling hysterically. And then I tried it again at the last day of school at this event we were at.
Mm-hmm.
And all the kids, because I was really... bully for being a little prude, among other things. And they were like, oh, wow, you're becoming cool. So I said it like twice, you know, that night. Just well-placed.
Well-placed.
Yeah.
Well,
I didn't overdo it.
And then
something happened in my mid-20s where I turned into a saucy, potty-mouthed sailor girl.
Totally. See, this
and I've gotten worse. And it makes no sense that I've had people who I care about who are smart tell me to knock it off, and I can't.
Can't fucking do it, bitch.
Exactly. I'm like, I don't know what the problem is.
Because you're all backed up. See, this is the thing about
it. I'm all backed up.
You know, and I've had friends who were raised in an even more permissive environment than I am, and they're even more stable than I am. I think we need these permissive environments for kids to be raised
up. Yeah, I was raised up. Yeah. Raised extremely cloistered and conservative.
No.
And I just... You know, very slowly, as I realized that the world was not going to break if I said one word or did this or did that, little small things.
Right.
And I've just been unraveling it for like 30, 40 years now.
And then 10 minutes later, you're trying heroin. Because they're lying about everything. If they lied about this, they probably lied about that.
Oh, I don't think they lied.
Now, I remember being told that you can say, look at that beaver dam, but not look at that damn beaver.
Really?
Context is everything. I guess.
It's like one of my favorite words is cooter.
Cooter, yeah. Oh no, what was it? There I was face to face with Patti Smith's cooter. This on that was that Colbert or the Daily Show?
Yeah.
And they were going out and there was
there was like some annual cooter days.
No, it was an endangered cooter.
Yeah, it was like
it's an animal.
It's a tortoisey turtle-y thing. Yeah.
And then the name of the forestry agent who's in charge of the area, her name is Patti Smith.
And she's holding it right there.
And she's holding it right there. And the reporter's like, there I was face to face with Patti Smith's cooter. Which sounds to me like, well, a fantastic talk show. Like, you, Charlie Rose, face-to-face with Patti Smith Scooter.
But Patti Smith's like my favorite rock star, so it's kind of weird.
It is
like, her cooter is off-limits.
I guess, if it's an option.
just kind of, you know, sacred.
It seems like it's unattainable.
Well,
I don't know if I...
She's, you know, in her 60s now, yeah, and yeah. I think her boyfriend just turned 30.
Yeah, man, Helen Mirren's like 95 years old. She's pretty hot.
Yeah.
60 is the new 25. If you're Patty. So then they also had the Little Orphan Annie Dakota Ring.
Oh, yes.
Thing. Now, this charmed me, too. You asked me, like, have I ever sent away from like that?
I did once.
Yeah.
And it was so annoying.
I did not the same.
Talk about anticlimactic. How can you do that to a kid? Make them wait 6 weeks for bullshit.
Yeah, well, it's marketing. You know, Don Draper is in charge of this whole operation. You know? There's a very cynical group of people on the other side of that radio.
But what it does, it just makes you not want to do it again, and it actually sours you on the product. I don't know what they were thinking.
And I never sent away for a Dakota Ring, but there were these little codes that would come on TV and you had to like puzzle them out or whatever, that kind of thing. And it always was something like that. It was always drink your Ovaltine, you know, or drink your Coca-Cola, smooth, refreshing Coca-Cola. And yeah, and it just feels like, well, I'm not going to bother next week. You know, if Spider-Man special message for me
is to eat cereal. Brad, Tracy, and Courtney.
Over at the Watchers of Anarchy.
Yes.
Absolutely.
You can continue.
Okay. Well, no, that was it. I'm agreeing. I guess I basically agree with you. So, yeah, when you're marketing to kids, it doesn't take, because here's the thing, it doesn't take much. Be sure to drink your Ovaltine is insulting the intelligence of a child. Right, but if you make it a quest, if you make it a little thing where you get part of a code and then you get another part of a code and another part of a code and adds up to drink your Ovaltine later on, the kid will be a little bit more invested than just having gotten the ring. So you want to give them a couple of little baubles, you know, there. And I think they do that now. I mean, now we have, like, you look at Transformers, for example. That was freaking genius. We need to sell these stupid toys. How are we going to do it? Make a whole cartoon. And now it's like, you know, they're making massive blockbuster movies out of it. That's the way you do it. Little Orphan Annie, nowhere to be seen. So, there's your lesson for marketing to kids. So your father's not going to kill. And then, okay, so he finally gets the... he goes to see Santa, right? Now growing up, my parents, especially my mom, was desperate to get us to go get a picture with Santa or the Easter Bunny.
Really?
At the mall, and we would never do it.
Why?
Because they're horrible alcoholic pedophiles.
I had some radar. I do want to know why.
I grew up in the...
It was the 70s for me and early and late 60s, and they were some weird Santas.
They were some weird Santas, but...
Is that about?
Well, here's the thing. It's, for me, it was the late...
How did that happen? Bad Santa.
For me, it was the late 70s, and I had been growing up hearing nothing about nothing but Charlie Manson, you know, and all these people.
Jim Jones
and all this. I'm like, yeah, well, they all look like fucking department store Santas to me. I don't want to... Next thing I know, I'm going to be in some kind of van with Linda Kasabian. I'm not going to do that.
Patty Hearst,
exactly. This is how
Dan White.
This is how the Patty Hearst Dan White thing happens. You know, so you start. It starts with a department store Santa. So I had this really like maybe negative instinct.
Maybe that's what happened with the Zodiac Killer.
Yeah, Zodiac. They had not found Zodiac at the time that you're sending us off to on these strangers.
He got lost in Santaville. He became a Santa. He became a Santa. And it just broke his brain.
Yeah. Totally. Right, yeah, so Zodiac was on the loose. Manson had just been caught. The Dan White thing was just happening. You know, there was a lot of chaos happening in this town. And you want to take me to some stranger, and no, forget it, you know. So, but later on in life, my brothers got, when they were adults, they got their picture taken with Santa. Like towering over him, like standing side by side.
And it's like a joke.
I gave it to my mom.
Oh, for a thing, yeah. They should have put like a little wet stain, like one of them peed on his leg or something.
Right, right. Well, and this is one of the moments for me that I want to relate to Die Hard, and we'll get to Die Hard like in a second. So he's up on the Santa thing, and he forgets what he wants, and the Santa like kicks him down, and he's going to slide down the slide. He grabs it and turns around and climbs up the slide, right, against all... you know, the laws of physics. And if you recall, in Die Hard, there's a moment where John McClane is in an elevator shaft and he gets knocked down a whole floor and he grabs an air vent on a lower floor that's like 10 or 15 feet below him, that's made out of galvanized aluminum, and his hands are covered in blood and sweat. There's no way he would have had any purchase on that thing. His hands would have just slid right off of it, and he would have kept falling, but he grabbed it. He held on to it. So this is another Ralphie John McClane moment. Is that they both can kind of master not sliding down the inevitable.
For the rest of my marriage, every right around Christmas Eve when we watch these two movies.
Oh yeah, no, it's coming together. It's coming.
I'm going to keep hearing about more and more.
We're going to find all the parallels. I've got all the parallels.
Yeah, John, yeah.
But then Santa says you'll shoot your eye out.
Well, they say, you know, IQ, it's intelligence is part of pattern recognition. And you do have one of those big fat IQs.
And I'm working on it. I'm putting it to good use.
Yes, I'm putting it to good use.
At least I'm off the Mount Everest thing. I'm going to do a whole cast on that just on my own one day, just down
just,
the corner.
Yeah, you just get that one out of your goddamn system.
Nah, I'm sending that one into Cracked, I think. I think they're going to
That's Cracked.com. That's, I love it.
Yeah. So then Santa says, you'll shoot your eye out, and like taps him on the head. And
with his foot? Then he puts his foot on him.
And then he slides down and he's completely defeated. I've never seen a child so defeated lying there next to his brother in this... this cushion, like completely cast out of heaven. It was so Paradise Lost. You know, it's like, we'll curse you, then I will rule in hell. My own gun. Yeah, cool. So then we roll on to Die Hard, and unless there's anything else you wanted to cover in Christmas Story,
I mean it's one of those movies where I do always see different things every time I watch it.
The bunny suit. Oh, the bunny. Forgot the bunny suit. I'm going to forget the bunny suit.
How could you forget the bunny suit, Jason?
Absolutely.
So some aunt of his sews a bunny suit for him.
Yes.
That's really well made.
she thinks he's 4 years old and a girl.
Yeah. So that's what he says. And then his dad helps him tactfully get out of it.
Yeah, dad gets him out of it.
Meanwhile, mom is practically in tears because he's so damn cute.
that really rang true. There's this thing growing.
And it's so funny because it's like, this is Christmas, and this is a bunny suit.
What did she get him on Easter?
I don't know.
Elf outfit. She's a little bit loopy. She's a hoarder, too. You know, her place, we're going to have to send the A&E
team. It's all Easter, all the time.
But the pink bunny suit and the look on McGavin's face when he's like, I've got to save my son.
Yeah.
I have to save my son. It's like Jack's going to Belfast.
I'm going to save my baby.
I must save my
from
baby.
From that suit.
From Jimmy and the suit. The bunny suit. And this is another thing, too. I mean, you like this movie. I know a lot of women who like the film, but there's disproportionately it's men who like this movie.
Really?
It's a little boy. You know, it's like a very male, oriented story. And I've run into a couple of women who have been like, I just don't get it. I don't get it.
I totally get it.
Yeah, but part of it is that whole bunny suit humiliation. That is like a deep, like little boy experience of you've got this aunt. That's the complete hell, is that your mother is requiring you to be cute in front of your father. Especially. Completely. That is just like...
It's like, just emasculate him before his balls even drop.
That is some Joseph Campbell stuff right there. That's something like Beowulf's mom would have made him do or like that. Yeah, so the bunny suit. But then he gets the gun... Before he got it, and he shoots the target, and he hits his own eye. So he's like,
aww.
I mean, first shot goes straight to the eyeball.
Yeah,
poor kid. And then he makes up the thing about the icicle, and the mom totally buys it, and so he gets to keep the gun and everything, and then he goes to sleep with it. It's old blue.
It's so cute.
And then they're in the Chinese restaurant because the dog stole.
I know they have their Jewish Christmas.
They have their Jewish Christmas. There's no, you don't see anybody else there. There's apparently no Jewish families in Wisconsin. And then they have the Chinese guys. The one Chinese guy.
And they're
like
trying so
more,
hard.
They're doing rah-rah-rah-rah-rah. It was a little like, okay. A little 1980s racism there, you know.
But it was like they were trying so hard to make this a great
And their
experience.
Chorus leader's Chinese. He's a little more Americanized. He's like, no. Fa-la-la-la-la. He can do it, right? He's like teaching the thing. And it's a little queasy way to end it. Even when I was a kid, I was like, really? You're going to Hong Kong Fooey? At the end of this, but it's also kind of rustic and charming in a little way, especially when you got the duck's head and he's like, it's smiling at me. Chop the head off. Because I remember a time, so like, you know, nowadays, especially, it's like Chinese food and Japanese food, it's all just food now, you know, here. But I can remember growing up that Chinese food was a little bit exotic. It was a little bit of a, like a strange thing to go get, and there would be like heads chopped off of things. Like I can only imagine that, like...
Oh man, when I was getting
30 years
cat
earlier,
and dog's food.
Yeah, oh, they're ground hearts.
Yeah.
Heart paste.
Yeah, hearts. And there's liver in there and turkey or chicken ground. But anyways, so I'm going to this butcher just over here on Mission.
Mm-hmm.
And I go in and there was literally like 10 pig heads staring at me.
Oh, yeah.
And they look waxy and weird. And then there was these two...
They have the faces. The
there was
faces.
These two hot chicks that were having a complete debate because they had ordered one, a whole pig.
A whole pig.
And it was being like rustled in the back and you could see this whole thing and they were supervising it. And it was, I mean, they had it on his back and they had him disemboweled and they were just analyzing this pig. I'm just sitting there going, you know what? I'm really close to becoming a vegan.
Or at least just sticking with ground meat. Textured vegetable protein. just seeing that the butchery of it.
Well, it was a little Cronenberg.
It's a little Cronenberg. It's like
and
something
also
out of...
pigs are an animal I would seriously consider for a pet. I almost adopted one once. You didn't know about this. It was about a year ago. It was Stephanie's idea.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
We'll talk about that offline.
Which is funny, because if you listen to our podcast, Stephanie calls me.
Let's focus on why we're here.
I'm going to regret showing you that movie.
Oh, was you want to recommend that one out?
Middleman?
The Middleman.
Oh,
about the guys who invented the financing system for online porn that allows people to buy porn relatively anonymously.
Uh-huh. Well, they ended up inventing... The basic
online billing for all online billing.
All online billing.
Yeah, but they were motivated by porn.
Yeah.
It's not Owen Wilson, it's the other Wilson.
James Caan plays a really amazing role.
James?
I didn't catch that it was him right at first. And then later I'm like, that's got to be James Caan.
Yeah, you could tell by his nose.
But he
looked a little different. But
he had shifted his mannerisms and stuff. It was really good acting.
He was kind of going in a sort of a, I'd almost say Dustin Hoffman direction. With the character a bit. It's like it felt like a Dustin Hoffman performance.
Yes.
And it was really good.
That's
It's more than I normally expect out of James Caan. I just really felt like he brought a lot more to that role than I've seen him do in a long time.
I'm a big fan of Thief.
Thief was really
I think a great movie.
Although talk about some 80s hair though.
Back to Christmas.
So then we're on to Die Hard. Now, so okay, here's my, in all seriousness, here's my thing with Die Hard. It is a Christmas movie. It takes place in Christmas. It is about, it does have a subplot about family and everything else like that. Everything is Christmas themed. It's not like, the reason I like it better than Lethal Weapon as a Christmas movie is because Lethal Weapon has Christmas appear a couple of random times in the course of the film, but it doesn't mostly, you know, it doesn't infuse the whole story with Christmasness. Whereas this takes place at a corporate Christmas party. There's Christmas decorations everywhere. There's, you know, they keep every 5 minutes they're bringing up that it's Christmas. And so I think it's much more of an, you know, Christmas is a character in the story. But it's a complete palate cleansing from watching a typical Christmas movie like A Christmas Story or It's a Wonderful Life or those kinds of things where it's this celebration of the holiday. This is like... You know, we all get this sense from time to time of just like, I'm just so over Christmas. I just want this to be done. I can't shop for another thing. I can't be jolly on command, you know. And it's just, there's no way to get through the holiday, you know, consistently throughout your life without at some point just feeling like you just want New Year's just to show up or whatever. And so what I like about Die Hard is that it gives you this chance to have this cathartic joy of this complete mayhem rumpus, explosions and helicopters and action and shooting with Christmas being a theme. And now for just a minute, you can be happy about something besides goodwill toward men. You know, so this is like negative will toward men. And it's just, it's a little cathartic. It's like having a little palate cleansing. Yeah. So let's call out to some of our performers here. We have, of course, Bruce Willis, you know, as John McClane. It's like his defining role, pretty much. It was like the film role that he first got that really, you know, defined who he was.
And you also talk about it being an action film that has set the standard.
Yeah.
For the modern day action
film. Yeah, well, it's John McTiernan. And he's, in terms of like visual storytelling, he also did Medicine Man and with John Connery and... Dr. Melfi, whose name slips my mind right now, and Hunt for Red October. And he's a very, very good action director. So he's visual storytelling. His movies tell themselves just by watching them, you know, which is fortunate because he doesn't always get the best performances. So you kind of do need the visuals to tell the story. And yeah, this, so Die Hard, so let me just give you a little background. I did a little research, a little background on Die Hard. One of the things that I always cracked me up with the Die Hard is, what do I have it here? Is the opening credits, it says, based on the novel by, I think it's Richard Thorpe. And you're like, really? The novel? That sounds like a fascinating read.
Yeah, it's a bit of a stretch. Like, did the novel get written at the same time the movie was written?
No, the novel was written 10 years earlier. I did all my, I got on Wikipedia. I found all
of
this stuff
out.
Okay, so here's the background on. So I remember seeing this as you know, I was a young adult when I first saw the film, and I was like, really, the novel? Because I'd be fascinated to read the whole like exploding elevator shaft, you know, chapter. And does that come before or after the wrestling the giant German mutant chapter? You know, what it was is this. So Die Hard was actually a sequel to a movie. Starring Frank Sinatra, called The Detective, based also on the novel by the same writer. And that was actually one of Frank Sinatra's most successful films. And it was, the book was written in the mid-60s and the film was made in 1968. And it's about a Los Angeles...
Oh, and Merry Christmas to the Winter Family.
Oh, to the Winter Family?
Yes. To Becky and Mike and...
Lauren. And
who
Lisa.
Lauren, who dresses so snazzy.
And these are my coworkers.
Yes.
And to the right, to Will and to Parker, and like that. And Goodwill Torn, and God Bless Us One and All.
I just love how I'm derailing you.
Just derailing me. Anyway, so The Detective, Sinatra, it's basically a Chinatown-style sex political investigation, sort of James Ellroy kind of piece. And apparently Sinatra made this movie. His name isn't John McClane. It's like John Leland or something like that. And then they 10 years later, after that movie was made, the author of the book, he saw Towering Inferno in 75, and then a couple of years later he had a dream about being chased by men with guns, and he had a great idea of mixing the two. This is like the Reese's Peanut Butter Cup of action novels. He said, why don't I have Towering Inferno, where there's terrorists inside who are trying to get something out of the building, and they're using the Inferno quality as a distraction from their thievery of what's inside, right? And that was his big plot, and he wrote it, and it's called Nothing Lasts Forever is the name of the novel. And they gave it to Sinatra. They wanted him to play this character. And he turned it down. It was like the mid-80s. By then, Sinatra was pretty old. He didn't want to act anymore. And so they rewrote it. They made the character younger. They changed everything around, and they made it. But the plot is basically the same. So apparently the plot of the book is pretty much what you see in the movie of Die Hard, except for it's his daughter and it's not his wife.
Ah.
But other, because he's older. He's much right. older. But
I think I would have liked that better.
Well,
I
maybe
not like that role or that actress.
Who, Bonnie Bedelia?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, but do you want her to be Sinatra's daughter? Yeah, then it should have been Nancy Sinatra. That would have been a movie.
That could have been
the a Sinatras movie. In Die Hard. We could have had that. We could have had Frank and Nancy on the Die Hards. anyway, so that's what the basis. So it just goes to show you, like in Hollywood, sometimes. You think you're going to starting with one thing. You think you're doing like a Frank Sinatra revival piece, and you end up inventing the modern action film, right? Mm-hmm. And the other thing they had going for them was, and I went to UCLA, so it's like this was like right around my neighborhood. I could see Nakatomi Plaza from my house. It's Century City, and it had been built like just the 2 years before I went to school. They had this building, you know, Fox had this building, and they said, "Well, look, we're about to rent this out. We're not going to have control of it anymore," you know. Before it's populated, why don't we blow up part of it and make a movie? I mean, no one's ever done this. No one's ever done a Towering Inferno movie with a real tower. It's always been models and stuff. And so that, I think, is what really made the movie really make its mark, is that they were scrappy.
Mm-hmm.
Is like the phrase you like to use.
Oh, I love scrappy.
Right. Well, they were scrappy with hundreds of millions of dollars, but it was still scrappy to say, let's do something that no visual effects company could ever do, no set designers could ever do, no art director could ever do. Let's build a skyscraper and actually have it be in jeopardy in a film, right? Mm-hmm. And it's the only other chance you'd have to do this is if you were tearing it down, right? Mm-hmm. So the two times you have is when you're building it up and when you're tearing it down. And so that's why Die Hard hasn't been really matched as an action film, you know, in all the years since, is that no one's ever had that opportunity. They've never had this building that they could just, you know, ravage the upper 10 floors of, you know, the way they could with that film. So I think these are the unique qualities about it that, that made it interesting. And the other thing about it, like being a Christmas movie, I remember like, so in 88, like the movie opens up and you're with Argyle and McLean and they're in the car and they're talking. And then Argyle plays this music and it's Christmas in Hollis by Run DMC. And at the time that was supposed to be, oh, ha ha, you know, inner city, you know, hip hop, you know, modern Christmas music. And wouldn't you really rather just hear Jingle Bells or something? But now Christmas in Hollis is a classic Christmas song. Everywhere I go, I hear Christmas in Hollis. Mm-hmm. You know, after a while, it starts to be like Silver Bells. I'm like, I got enough with the Christmas in Hollis already. Don't you guys have something, any new Christmas songs? We also have William Atherton as the reporter. He's like the classic 80s douchebag villain. He was the same exact character in Ghostbusters. He was the EPA agent mm-hmm. who quite reasonably wanted to know if you guys with the nuclear accelerators on your back were keeping any poisonous stuff in your basement. And he got dicked around by Bill Murray. And every time I watch that movie, it's like, you know, as a taxpayer, I kind of wanted Murray to show him the containment unit. You know, I really kind of am not comfortable with just you can smart mouth the EPA out of your building because you're keeping ghosts down there. And he was also the evil science professor in Real Genius, who was like also a Defense Department contractor building a weapon that can vaporize people from space, and he's using undergraduates to do it. He's got like this undergraduate physics majors in his little lab at like UCLA or something like that, building a laser that he's going to give to the military, you know, and then of course Val Kilmer, you know, completely screws him up. So it's always good to see him, you know, being douchey.
Always good to see this actor being douchey.
Oh, it is. You know, Atherton, I don't think he's ever played any other kind of character. I mean, he's never played like...
He's a professional douche replicant.
No, a douche is something that a woman in her right mind might want to have close to her body. So I don't know what else to call him. I'm just a colloquial douche, I guess.
Colloquial douche?
Not a literal one. I don't think you'd want to literally use him as a douche.
Oh, we cannot show this cast up.
William, that would be, he should become a spokesman for a line of feminine hygiene products. It'd be like one of those like producers kind of scenarios where you're trying to.
How do we turn out like this? I mean, we're pretty decent people and we are just naughty little kids.
We're just awful. This whole thing would get us soap in our mouths. We'd have to become connoisseurs. But of course, to me, like the top performances in the film, of course, Alan Rickman as Hans, you know. Hands down is the best. But I also really like Hart Buchner as the coked up, type A executive guy with no sense of himself at all and completely stupidly like tries to negotiate with terrorists. You see, isn't that like the first thing they tell you not to do? Don't negotiate with terrorists, right? He literally goes and tries to negotiate with terrorists and gets himself shot, you know. But he's like doing coke off of his desk and all this other stuff. And I just thought he really got that energy, that coked up yuppie energy, that, you know, that kind of that Patrick Bateman thing, you know, going pretty well. Most of the other performances, like the other performances, I was never a huge Bruce Willis fan. I agree, Bonnie Bedelia could have been plugged in with almost anybody else and that would have been okay. But Rickman and Buchner, I think.
Yeah,
kind of really bring it. And I got to give a shout out here to the Lifetime Achievement Award winner for henching, who is Al Leong. He is the Asian terrorist, balding Asian terrorist with the long hair and back and the male pattern baldness. This guy is the hardest working man in show business. He is the Asian Danny Trejo. He has been in Big Trouble in Little China,
mm-hmm.
And any number of like Steven Seagal movies and things like that, and Die Hard, and he's worked with Carpenter a lot. And he's one of those guys you see, and he's like, "There's that guy," you know, he's always like, he's like a kung fu expert and everything else. And so I'm really looking, what I need to see before I shuffle off this mortal coil is a road movie with him and Danny Trejo.
Oh, the two brilliant.
Of them, two of them together. Machete and the Henchman.
Oh, that sounds really good.
Yeah, and he can act too. He can speak. He's got a very strong California accent. He's not like what's his name, Channing Fat, who has trouble with English. He's an American, right? And so they just never let him speak. They never give him a line because they don't want to pay him.
No, that's a great idea.
Yeah, no, I think Trejo and Leong. Yeah, totally. It's called the Henchman.
It's like two middle-aged henchmen.
This is two guys henching their way across the world. Yeah, two middle-aged henchmen. So, but Hans, I mean, that was the other thing. When I first saw the film, I was like, you know, I was not expecting any performances that I was going to care about, you know, even at a young age. I was like, oh, I just want to see some stuff blow up. And I was just real, I had never seen Alan Rickman before on anything. I think he did a few things before this, but this is the first thing I saw him in. And
he was so Lincoln Potter.
Lincoln Potter, yes. I was going to throw that out.
From Sons of Anarchy.
You brought that up last night.
Last season, yes.
And I'm starting to realize, is what I'm liking about Lincoln Potter. I hadn't put the two mm-hmm. together, but Lincoln Potter reminds me of Hans Gruber. He mm-hmm. really does. You know, mm-hmm. he amuses himself with his little jokes, mm-hmm. you know, and his little asides.
And he's, you know, he's arrogant and a little snarky.
Snarky and arrogant and kind of sociopathic, you know. Although I guess Potter's probably not as murderous, but they're both kind of like willing to cut people loose underneath them and everything else like that. And, you know, and they have these overly elaborate and constructed plans, you know. Speaking of which, the plan in Die Hard, the bad guy's plan, is one of the most unnecessarily elaborate plans in history. You're going to stage he's like, okay, the whole idea is I want everybody to think I'm, I don't know what that was. I want everybody to think I'm dead, right, so I can get away with this money. Which I guess is not serialized in any way. Nobody's going to identify. Hey, there's 600 million bearer bonds missing from Nakatomi Plaza. If anybody shows up at your brokerage with a $600 million in bonds, it's probably Hans and his people, you know. And he's doing this. He's got this plan is like for two reasons. One is to make everybody think you're dead. So you're going to blow up the roof when you get to the top of it and you're not going to be up there. Okay, that's one thing. And the other thing is that you need the FBI to cut the power to the building so that you can get into the vault, right? Because you can cut through every other lock, but the electric magnetics cannot, for some reason, cannot be cut locally. There's some reason why you couldn't just drill down your... But it seems to me that it would have been a whole hell of a lot easier to get one of your guys into that manhole where the guy threw the switch and turned off the power to the building. Right? The FBI orders this guy in a hat, who's, you know, some Union City worker, cut off Nakatomi Plaza, and that guy can just do that. He can just... like one bolt and he has to call downtown. He has to call downtown to do it, but it can be done. And it seems like you would just do that rather than stage this whole elaborate. You're trying not to draw attention to yourself when you steal things. You want to like just swipe it and get out of there. But so there you are. So Lincoln Potter, this is how I love when he comes with, so like the Lincoln Potter moment for me is definitely the interview with Takagi where he's trying to get the key code and mm-hmm. he looks at the model. He's like, oh, look at this beautiful. The attention to detail. This is Lincoln Potter. As a boy, I loved to make models. You know, I could talk about industrialization and men's fashions all day, but work, I'm afraid, must intrude.
And you can just see that he would totally mince.
Yeah.
He would get on a table and mince.
He'd be dancing up on the table.
Him and Potter were like co-stars together, which I think those two actors definitely play like... evil cousins or something.
Brothers or cousins. It's kind of like a Justified thing. It's like lawmen chasing each other across the Southwest.
Yeah.
You know, one breaks, breaking, they each break bad in different ways, you know.
Yeah.
You know, and then Takagi plays the ultimate bluff here. You can see he's sweating and like that. He says, well, I don't know the code. You're just going to have to shoot me. And then, so they shoot him anyway. And it's like, well, there was probably not a reason to shoot him.
Hold on, I got a dog issue. Let's make a choice here. Give her to me.
All right, you got the dog. So let's see. So we have. Then we also have Al Powell, played by Reginald Vell Johnson, who's on a lot of TV shows and things like that. And he's in the books apparently. He's a character that it's called Al Powell. And he becomes like the narrator. He's like the proxy for the audience. It's like every time something's happening where the director had some sense that this is just going to be a series of explosions and people aren't going to know why they're going off, you have Powell saying, "Can't you see what's happening here?" And he's lecturing everybody around. He's like yelling at the FBI, yelling at his bosses. And it's like, well, gee, no wonder you're on this bullshit patrol. You know, if you keep yelling at people. The one element of the movie I probably would have cut was the Powell "I shot a kid" story. You know, he and John are talking, and John's like apologizing to his wife, and Powell's like, you know, "I shot a kid accidentally, he had a toy gun." And then Alexander Goodenough comes out after being hung at the end of the movie, and Powell shoots him, and there's this huge swelling music. As you can see, he's got a good shoot now. He's killed a terrorist. So that just fixes it. You know, that's like, oh, I'm all better now. I shot a kid. I'm nervous about having a gun. I'm still out patrolling. But now I shot a German terrorist. So I guess Merry Christmas to me. That's like this moment of like, oh, good. I'm so glad he got to shoot somebody, because now everything's all better. Bullets make everything all better. You know. And then, but what do we have? We had the line where it was, the spirit of Christmas comes up when the what's his name, who was the douchey principal from Breakfast Club, says, "Jesus Christ, I guess we're going to need more FBI guys."
You were like, the spirit of Christmas.
That's the spirit of Christmas
right
there.
You're in bed and you're shouting, "The spirit of Christmas, more FBI guys."
More FBI guys. So,
courtesy of Jesus Christ.
Yeah, and the other character I really like, actually the other performance I really like is I forgot the character's name, but he's the computer expert, the hacker, right? And when they're doing the first police like attack on Nakatomi Plaza, and he's like watching from their surveillance cameras and guiding the rocket launcher guys, he's like, "Oh, the police have themselves an RV." You know, then they blow it up. He's like, "Oh, the quarterback is toast." You know, and it's like, yes, okay. And then I even caught this when I first saw it. It's like, okay, so there's the good sassy black guy and the bad sassy black guy. And at the end of the movie, the good sassy black guy has to punch out the bad sassy black guy.
That is so weird.
It's just like really, they just really paired up everything here. I guess it's a good thing there weren't any, you know, Asian. No, there were a bunch of Asian good guys. I'm surprised they didn't have one of them attack Ali Leong. You know, but he got shot by Bruce. So I remember things like, oh, sure, you have the brother hit the brother. It's like, okay, black on black violence. What, you know, what's that about, Die Hard? Yeah. So anyway, so we really, I mean, this is, the other thing is the Volksfrei movement, which is what Hans was, Hans Bubby, I'm Your White Knight. Hans was in the Volksfrei movement. If you Google that now, there's a whole bunch of little organizations out there now called the Volksfrei movement. They're like little online clubs and
Are
stuff
you serious?
Like that. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's like there's like a whole Facebook page dedicated to the Volksfrei movement.
Oh, Merry Christmas to my almost 800 Facebook friends.
800 Facebook friends, and Merry Christmas to everybody over at Uncommon Grounds.
Oh yes, Val.
Val, and you're gonna go see
Val
and
Ruben?
James. And I don't remember the staff's name. But this is our favorite cafe in Berkeley.
Love on Common Grounds. And Val and I share a complete addiction to the BBC mysteries.
Yeah.
And also to
Anglophiles.
The Swedish and the Norwegian and Icelandic mysteries, too.
Yeah.
I'm a huge Scottish fan. She's really into the...
And you guys are going to go see Dragon Tattoo together.
Yes, we are.
Yes.
We're a couple of...
Can go see the girl with the drag queen fondue.
You kill me.
Yeah.
I always have to ask myself, where did I find you?
Where did you find you? Well, Merry Christmas to your father, and I'm sure he's not going to listen to this. But let's just say that
our dads are.
Let's record
like
evidence.
The same age, and yeah. They have similar backgrounds, and it would be just like, okay,
it would be torture
be
to hear it. Oh, those kids.
How do I get out of not listening to this?
But they should still have a Merry Christmas.
But, you know, dads, you gotta be pleased. We never ask you for money.
We fit in this world. we're creatures
world.
Of our world.
We dug our own spot out. We've been generous,
generous.
We are a completely self-reliant.
You're reliant, and we're all to be prosperous.
A lot of people would be really pleased to have kids as cool as we are.
Totally. Yes, exactly.
So we might not be the churchgoers you would like, or the synagogue goers you would like, or the Republicans you would like. or whatever. And neither of us did time in the Marines or the Navy like you guys did.
But we are here.
And we're both oldest children, too, which is that unusual for oldest children?
Well, I'm not my father's oldest child. I'm my mother's oldest child. But I was raised as an oldest child because my older siblings are like 10 and 12 years older than I am. So they're more like aunt and uncle.
Yeah.
So I have an older child's psychology.
Yeah. And you would think that we would fight more.
You and I?
Yeah.
I sure hope not. Over what?
You're not a big fan of fighting.
No.
You're Mr.
I like
Love.
To be.
You're,
well, I don't mind fighting. I just like to be over and get
you're
to
a love
resolution.
Bunny.
I'm a snuggle bunny.
You're awesome.
I'm awesome.
I'm gonna kiss you.
Well, do we have anything else for any other Christmas wishes or diehard memories and dreams? No.
You know what I need?
What do you need?
That I'm not getting.
What's that?
Oh, honey, this is a tragedy.
What's that?
I need to hear the South Park Christmas special album.
You mean the thing, how you can suck all the dick you want and still be a virgin?
There's that one. Okay, our fathers are now been hospitalized.
Oh, thud. That's on basic cable. You can hear that song.
Oh, you know, Swiss Colony Beef Log.
Swiss Colony Beef Log, okay.
Mr. Hankey.
Mr. Hankey, the Christmas Boo. Howdy ho, Kyle.
You're so good at the voices. And I have one in the bathroom.
We have a Hankey in the bathroom.
Little statue. I got it when we lived at your house for a while.
Yes. I've had people go in there and say, I can't believe you have Mr. Hankey in the bathroom. I can't
well,
use
where else are you going to put him?
I can't use the place you're going to put him. Which, is there a reason you have to have him?
Yes. He's a celebration of life.
I think we should hide him on Passover for the children to find. He's the Loft Omen. He's an Easter egg.
Or we can get 8 bags of him and put one in each bag for Hanukkah and light them all on fire. 20 bags of Mr. Hanky Poo.
Okay, well, we're running a little over time. So,
and we have to get to the hospital.
And we're going to be continuing with Breaking Bad and getting into Justified in the next month. We're just about done with try to hit our first Justified cast next week.
Big cast, hopefully next week, and I'm hoping to get some friends in here too.
Yeah.
So that's another thing. You're going to start meeting some of our crazy friends. A lot of them are storytellers, different mediums, but a lot of filmmakers, actors, computer gaming nerds,
and everything.
Just anybody I can come up with.
Well, until next week and until next Christmas, remember that this was no boating accident.
Ouch! I just put my hand on the heater.
Ouch.
Howdy ho! Virgin Mary was sleeping when Angel Gabriel appeared. He said, "You are to be the Virgin Mother," but Mary thought that was weird. Mary said, "I'm not a virgin. I blew a guy last year." But then Gabriel said to Mary, "My child, have no fear. 'Cause you can suck all the dick you want and still be a virgin. Mary, you can suck all the dick you want and still not be considered flawed. Although you went to town and sucked some semen down, you're still a virgin in the eyes of God." There was no room at the inn when Mary and Joseph did arrive, but they were so very tired, you see, and Mary had to offer a bribe. Since she had no money, how would she pay for a place to sleep? Gabriel appeared to Mary and told her not to weep. 'Cause you can suck all the dick you want and still be a virgin. Mary, you can suck all the dick you want and still be the mother of Christ. If there's no room at the inn, then it's not considered a sin to suck some dick to get a room for the night.